Another day is here, and you're ready for it. What to wear? Check. Breakfast, lunch, and dinner? Check. Planning for what's next and how to save for it? That's where Bank of America can help. For your financial to-dos, Bank of America has experts ready to help get you closer to your goals. Get started at one of our local financial centers or 24-7 in our mobile banking app. Find a location near you at bankofamerica.com/talktous. What would you like the power to do? Mobile banking requires downloading the app and is only available for select devices. Message and data rates may apply. Bank of America NA, member FDIC.
I am thrilled with today's guest. He has become a kind of a pop culture icon. He comes from the world of academia, and he's climbed into the world of just who we are and how we think and what we do. He's got a new Amazon bestseller. It will automatically be a New York Times bestseller, not even a question. The book is called The Algebra of Wealth, A Simple Formula for Financial Security. Of course, I'm talking about Scott Galloway. He's also the co-host of the Brilliant Pivot podcast with a good friend of the show, Kara Swisher, which is a Webby winner this week for podcasts. He's also the host of the Prof G podcast. He produces a weekly newsletter about the digital economy called No Mercy, No Malice. He is a professor of marketing at NYU Stern. And I am a big fan, and thanks for being here. I really appreciate it. And how busy you are, my friend.
Let me just say, I'm really enjoying this podcast so far, Donnie. I'm right with you. Anyway, great to be with you, Donnie.
Yeah, and I said off camera, I want to say it here, that you were on Morning Joe, of course, my favorite show, and it was a bravo performance, the way you handled talking about what's going on with Israel and with the students on campus and what you talked about with young people. We're going to talk about that today, but it's popping up everywhere on my social media, so you really hit a nerve there.
Well, and I said this off mic, Donnie, and I mean this sincerely. We're brothers from another mother on this, and you have been steadfast. You kind of gave cloud cover for those of us who felt this way to talk about it. You've been saying essentially the same thing consistently on Morning Joe. And I don't go on a lot of TV because I find, generally speaking, it's empty calories. There's better ways to promote your stuff or get your ideas across. First off, Morning Joe is a juggernaut. And the reason I hit number one on Amazon, which I realized is a flex, about 3 hours after I went on Morning Joe. I mean, yeah. The viewership. They also do a great job. It's just a tight show. They set you up for success. They obviously know their stuff. The hosts, Mika, Joe, Willie, they're just so good.
Yeah.
But also, I just really appreciate the show's fearlessness on this issue, because media companies are getting a lot of pushback, especially from their younger viewers, and a lot of them don't agree with us. So I'm very loyal, even though I don't know those guys very well, and the fact they bring you on to talk about this a lot. So
yeah, they really tee it up. They're brave, because the network overall is not necessarily in that direction. And it really is a bastion. I want, for our audience, I'd love you to just kind of, we'll start with that. We're going to sell a lot of books today. We're going to get to that. But I want to kind of start with that, when Joe basically said to you, so you're an NYU professor. How do you feel about what's going on campuses around here?
So I went to the protest just to check it out at NYU, and I was on campus all day yesterday. I do think that, you know, the media loves controversy and violence and things that are upsetting. And I do think the vast majority of the protests on these campuses have been peaceful and have repeated the strong and longstanding legacy of young people pushing the boundaries of their thoughts and expressing them in a forceful way, peacefully. We're known for that on campus. We're known for that apartheid, Vietnam, whatever it might be. And I think most of it is peaceful and buttresses the notion of free speech and that young people should express their views. The problem is that a small but not insignificant number of times that free speech turns to hate speech, and sometimes it gets very emotional, and some individuals begin targeting, harassing, and intimidating members of a special interest group on campus, specifically Jews. And I am very comfortable with a university going out of its way to give a 19-year-old a really wide berth around peaceful protest. I think that's a good thing, and I think most of it has been peaceful. What I am not down with, or I see an inconsistency around, is one, I think faculty should be held to a higher standard, and two, if I were to go down to the square or the plaza at NYU with a white hood and a Confederate flag and start saying that I think, you know, Jews will not replace us, or that if I started saying lynch the blacks or burn the gays, I think that right away I would be fired, first off. And if I in any way added to an atmosphere where a Jewish kid walking across the plaza felt unsafe and felt that they might be physically harmed, and I started verbally assaulting them with the type of hate speech that you see on a regular basis in these protests, Donnie, I think they'd call in the fucking National Guard.
Yeah.
I don't think we'd wrap ourselves.
There'd be no negotiations. There would be no.
There'd be no need for nuance. Yeah. There'd be context would not be required. We wouldn't be wringing our hands over this existential conversation around free speech or First Amendment. They would bring in men and women in uniforms with semi-automatic rifles.
Yeah, right, right.
And they would ensure that those gay kids or those black kids correctly, justifiably, felt safe. So I see a different set of standards when this hate speech and intimidation is targeted at Jews.
You've been very articulate. You gave great historical examples about how, you know, obviously Israel's being criticized for genocide, and you talk about obviously there we killed 7,000 U.S. servicemen were killed by the Japanese in Pearl Harbor, and we killed 3 million Japanese, and you go on and on and on with the examples like that. And the civilian to casualty rate for Israel has been less than historically what's happened in Mosul with the U.S. So then the big $1 million question, or the big question, is why? Why is it different? I call it being graded on a curve. That hate, when it comes to Jews, is graded on a curve. So why? I know this is not a simple answer. I know there is no one answer. But why the fuck do you think that is?
So I'll talk about historical and then present day. Historically, I just have absolutely no idea. You can type in any century. 3rd century, anti-Semitism. 8th century, anti-Semitism. As a species, we just seem to be, in a modern society, really good at every 30, 50, 100 years, taking a really big problem, whether it's the aristocracy in Russia or an economically impaired Germany, and finding this scapegoat called Jews. We're just really good at it. And Hitler, to a certain extent, he took European Jewry down from 15 million to 9 million, and it's taken us, you know, 70, 80 years to get back to the point we were before World War II. But the Mormon faith has about the same number, I think, of people, number of Jews in the U.S. If every 50 or 100 years we decided they were the culprits for a problem, I don't think the religion would survive. And it's not a given that our religion is going to survive. I just don't understand the tribal nature of, well, I have an easier time understanding the tribal nature and the hate of the human species that occasionally bubbles up. I don't understand why it's always the same, or it's the everyone's favorite target throughout history. Now, coming to present day, I think there's a confluence of a few things. The first is, just to be fair, Israel has not draped itself in glory over the last 30 or 40 years. I think if we're going to have an open and honest conversation about this, we've gone from David to Goliath. It's not the Israel I grew up with. I think Netanyahu has been diabolical. And has made a deal with the devil, the far-right contingents of his own nation that
You're
are quite frankly bigoted.
You're right.
There are bigots in the Knesset. There's been over-settlements. I understand the resentment and the fact that 80% of people our age support Israel, and it's 20% people under the age of 25. I think you're seeing an incorrect conflation across mostly young people and far-left groups of lazy thinking, where they conflate the civil rights movement and the struggle of the Palestinian people. I think that we have, unfortunately, in campuses created this orthodoxy of oppressors and oppressed. And the easiest shorthand for your lazy, fast-thinking, reptile brain to figure out who the oppressors are is how white and how rich
wealthy
they are.
Yeah.
And the perception, fairly or not fairly, is that the ground zero for wealth and whiteness is Israel and is Jews. So they must be the oppressors. I also think that, and I know this sounds paranoid, but it doesn't mean I'm wrong. I think something is going on online, and that is the frame through which young people determine the world. We are where we spend our time. My frame is the New York Times, CNN, the Wall Street Journal. That kind of shapes my worldview, PBS, et cetera. A disproportionate amount of our youth worldview is shaped through a platform that I believe is influenced, if not controlled, by the CCP, who cannot beat us economically, cannot beat us militarily. So what do we have? we have a platform that for every one pro-Israel video served, 52 pro-Hamas, pro-Palestine videos are served.
That blew me away. You said that the other day, and it blew me away. I knew it was very skewed. I had no idea it was that extreme.
Well, what's interesting is you think, well, Scott, come on. It's just young people. You don't agree with young people that the viral nature of these algorithms promotes stuff, speedballs it. But if you go on the control group, which would be Reels and Instagram, it's dramatically, the ratio is dramatically less skewed. And if you go on other hot emotional issues, Uyghur genocide, there are 600 times as many Uyghur genocide videos being shown on Reels as on TikTok. Stand with Kashmir, which is giving the Indian government problems, which the Chinese are in favor of, that has dramatically more presence on TikTok than on Reels. So somebody is putting their thumb on the scale here. Now, either Mark Zuckerberg is putting his thumb on the scale of Uyghur content and free Tibet content, and having, I believe I know Mark Zuckerberg pretty well. I don't think he cares. I think he will always opt for money. I don't think he has a political agenda.
I agree.
I do think the CCP has a strategic imperative around dividing us. And let me be clear, I don't even think it's anti-Semitism. I think it's anti-Americanism. If young people were vastly pro-Israel and the old people were vastly pro-Hamas, they'd be serving up pro-Israel videos to the youth. Their goal is polarization and to sow chaos. And also, Donnie, we would do the exact same thing if we had access to this unbelievable propaganda tool. Yeah. We have Radio Free Europe, Radio Free America, a PSYOPS group. To think that we wouldn't do this is naive. And Americans are easier to fool than convince they've been fooled. I think we're going to look back and go, how could we have been this stupid?
Well, at least there's a step being taken to, you know, to maybe figure out, maybe our number one geopolitical adversary should not be controlling the minds of our young people. Maybe somebody figured that out.
There's that. There's that.
Maybe that's a good thing. Hey, let's get to the book, The Algebra of Wealth, A Simple Formula for Financial Security. Could you also name the book, Jesus, young people are really getting fucked today, particularly young males?
Yeah, look, I there's just, the data is overwhelming. There's been no group globally that's ascended faster than women. More women are pursuing tertiary, secondary educational attainment than women globally. More women are pursuing higher education now than men globally, which is amazing when you account for the fact a lot of nations discourage it. And also, the number of women elected to parliament globally has doubled in the last 30 years. There's been no group in America that has fallen further faster than young men. And specifically, young people are seeing for the first time that at the age of 30, they're not doing as well as his or her parents were at 30, which is essentially a breakdown in the social compact. Yeah. And it creates rage. And I think it ties back to some of these protests on campus. I think every justified movement that warrants discussion, I think that cut turns into an opportunistic infection. I think there's just rage and incendiary poured over every issue we have because the social compact has broken down and young people don't have as much money. The average 70-year-old is 72% wealthier than they were 40 years ago. The average person under the age of 40 is 24% less wealthy. We continue to transfer $1.5 trillion a year from young people to the wealthiest generation in the history of the planet through Social Security. The two biggest tax deductions, capital gains and mortgage interest. Who buys and sells stocks? Who owns stocks and owns homes? People our age. Who rents and makes all their money from current income? Young people. The child tax credit, $34 billion a year, gets stripped out of the infrastructure bill, but the $135 billion increase per year in a cost of living adjustment for Social Security sails through. Almost everything we do in America, including the COVID stimulus, which was $7 trillion into the market, which sent the value of incumbents' assets skyrocketing and made it more expensive for new entrants who don't have a home yet, don't have a business yet, don't have stocks yet. Keep those prices high. Got to keep the boomers rich. I think almost every major expenditure, social or economic program in this country is nothing but an elegant transfer of wealth from the young to the old. And I think they are correctly, justifiably enraged. They look up, they see all this prosperity, and then it's speedballed by these algorithms that have people vomiting their personal assets and experiences, most of which is fake. And young people are more anxious, more depressed, and less optimistic than any generation in history. 55% of our people, Donnie, extremely proud to be American. It's 18% of people under the age of 25. People aged 30 to 34 just 40 years ago, 60% of them had at least one child. Now it's 27%. Young Americans are opting out of America. They're not having kids.
It's funny you talked about it yesterday on the air. I said, you know, beyond, if you asked, stop the protesters, and we know how you feel about Israel. How do you feel about the United States? You'd hear how they feel about the United States, that they hate it. And it's just that that's no surprise with those numbers there. You know, the book is so interesting. It's really a playbook for young people. And you and Warren Buffett figured out the same kind of thing. Hey, compounding interest, not such a bad thing. You kind of figure that out. You'll be eight times in 20 years, you create 8X wealth factor. And, you know, we have a young generation, obviously, that's brought up on speed and fastness and instant gratification. And your book kind of says, hey, guys, wait a second. Take a breath here.
Yeah, and I'm not saying you should put all your money into low-cost index funds. I mean, that's a smart thing to do. But if you're like me and you're a narcissist and you think you have special insight into the market and can pick stocks, then have at it. You know, take some money, buy crypto, try and find the next NVIDIA, have at it. But after spending the better part of three or four decades with literally the brightest minds in investments and the brightest finance professors, I've come to the following conclusion. No one has any fucking idea. The only thing we know is that over time, because of demographics and this incredible culture of innovation that's unique to America, the markets go up and to the right. Any one stock has a 50.1% chance of going up. In every few years, it's likely to go down 30 or 40%. But if you bought any five stocks in the S&P and you held onto them for at least 10 years, no one has ever lost money. And 11% a year sounds like chump change when you're 25. The next 21 years, and you can validate this, are going to go so fast, and you'll have eight times your revenue investing in these really boring, low-cost S&P index funds. So, you know, I say in the book, the good news is I really do know how to get you rich. With a little bit of discipline and the right strategy and a little bit of maturity, I can get you rich. That's the good news. The bad news is the answer is slowly. And this is a lesson of pain. I always made a shit ton of money, but I didn't diversify. I always went all in on my businesses. And when the dot bomb implosion happened in 2000 and the great financial recession came along, and then you throw in a divorce in there, I ended up at the age of 40 when my first kid came marching out of my girlfriend, having made millions of dollars, and I was broke.
Yeah.
And it was so hard on my mental health. It was so just devastating. And I want young people to avoid that pain. If I just put a little bit of money in a boring S&P index fund, never looked at it, and just let it grow, yeah, I might not have had hundreds or tens of millions, but I would have had a few million bucks, and that really would have helped at the right times. So this isn't be a baller like me. It's avoid some of the mistakes I've made growing up around financial immaturity.
You just use the word boring, and I'm going to go, one of my favorite things you use, I got this so wrong. I used to have this show on CNBC, The Big Idea, where I would interview, you know, titans of industry and successful entrepreneurs. And like them, I would say the key to success is find your passion. And you're one of the first guys to figure out, no. Maybe that's just a bunch of rich guys talking. I think your analogy is guys who made their money in smelting or something like that. But it's such a brilliant insight that you came up with. No, find something you're fucking good at.
Look, anyone who tells you to follow your passion on a college campus is already rich.
Yeah.
And what I find hilarious is they made their billions in selling plumbing supplies. And young people mistake passion for hobbies. Like, I don't want to crush anyone's dream. If you want to be an athlete, if you want to be an artist, if you want to open a nightclub, a restaurant, be a global fashion designer, you better get very strong signals very early that you're in the top 1%. Because here's the thing about those industries. They have a 90%+ unemployment rate. The most talented actors in the world are in SAG-AFTRA. There's 180,000 of them. 87% of them didn't qualify for health insurance last year because they made less than 23 grand. So your job isn't to find your passion, it's to find your talent and figure out something you're good at. And by the way, it may take you three or four tries. I thought I was going to be a pediatrician. Chemistry and UCLA disabused me of that notion. I thought I was going to be an athlete. UCLA athletics taught me I was not nearly good enough an athlete. I thought I was going to be an investment banker. Working at Morgan Stanley taught me I wasn't that good at that. I kept workshopping until I found something that I was naturally good at and could be great at. And for me, it was analytics and consulting and teaching. And I became a master at it. And the mastery of anything, the accoutrements of mastery, economic security, prestige, relevance, will make you passionate about whatever that thing is. And you know what I'm passionate about, Donnie? I'm passionate about taking care of my kids. I'm passionate about being able to step in when my father's turning 93 and support him economically. I'm passionate about having a larger selection set of mates than I deserve because I am economically secure. All of these things are wonderful things. And anything that provides that for you, you will become passionate about that thing. So find what your talent is. Commit to becoming a master, a ninja at it. And then most importantly, try and find an industry where there's a 90%+ employment rate. Because if you're just in the top 10%, you're going to be economically secure. So you want to go to where the waves are great and the snow is great. And that's in non-romantic industries. Yeah. The return on your invested capital will be inversely correlated to how sexy the industry is.
And somehow, to your point, when you're making money and you're getting all the accoutrements that come with that, the passion kicks in.
You mentioned
mating. And I love your insights about the dating apps and how it kind of takes young men in a certain socioeconomic or certain physical stature or lack of physical stature down a certain rabbit hole.
If online dating were an economy, it'd be more unequal than Venezuela. 50 men on Tinder, 50 women on Tinder. 46 of the women will show all of their attention exclusively to just 4 men, leaving 46 men fighting over 4 women, because we don't want to have an honest conversation about mating because it sounds sexist. And I am a sexist, and I have evidence that shows that 95% of people are binary and are predisposed to certain behaviors. You don't believe me? Put dolls and cars in a room and then letting a boy and a girl and see what happens.
I hear you. I'm with you.
And women have a much finer filter for mating. And online, women don't get to experience a guy's kindness, body language, the way he treats his parents, how good he is in a presentation. And 75% of married couples say the following: one person was much less interested in the other before they actually got together.
That's a brilliant insight.
And the persistence and multidimensional things that women are attracted to, most of them happen offline. So online becomes a very reductive distillation of features. For men, it becomes, for women, it's all about, quite frankly, their aesthetic, their looks. For women, it's all about their ability to signal resources. And the bad news is, or the good news is, for women, men are much less choosy. Oh, she looks cute, swipe right. Women will literally say, I don't like what he's wearing, swipe left. Men are much more inclined. If you ask a man, if a woman had 80% of everything, would you want to be serious with her? 2/3 say yes. You ask women the same question, 2/3 say no. They're like, I can have it all. And women need to be more choosy because the downside of sex is much greater for them than the downside of men. We're taught to spread our seed to the four corners of the earth. They're taught to put up a finer filter to find the strongest, smartest, and fastest seed. So they naturally have much higher criteria. So the top 10% of attractiveness of males get 80 to 90% of the attention. And what this does is, one, it doesn't create good behavior across that 10% who find there's no reason to ever form a long-term relationship and sometimes not even a good reason to treat women well. And the bottom half of men are totally shut out of the mating market, and they get validation that they have no worth in the mating market. And if they're not careful, they start a downward spiral and, quite frankly, start becoming more prone to misogynistic content and start blaming women. So online dating has sort of speedballed this winner-take-most environment in our broader economy, but across the mating market. In addition, just generally speaking, women mate socioeconomically horizontally and up, men horizontally and down. But the pool of horizontal and up among men is shrinking every year. More single women own homes than single men now. There's going to be almost 2-to-1 college graduates that are female in the next 5 years than males.
Incredible.
The bottom line is women don't want to mate with an economically and emotionally unviable man, and we're producing too many of them. So 2 in 3 women under the age of 30 have a boyfriend, only 1 in 3 men under the age of 30. And you think, well, that's mathematically impossible. No, it's because women are dating older and older because they want economically and emotionally viable men. We're producing too many unviable young men.
Hi, everybody. This is Adriana Trigiani. I'm the host of You Are What You Read, a podcast about the books that built our souls. I have the privilege of interviewing luminaries of our times about the books that shaped them from childhood until now. Don't miss it. We get everybody from Sarah Jessica Parker to Kristen Hanna to Jhumpa Lahiri, Susie Essman, Rainn Wilson, Amor Towles, you name it, they come, they talk, they share. You can join us on Instagram for more behind-the-scenes content and giveaways at You Are What You Read Podcast and at Adriana Trigiani. New episodes of You Are What You Read drop every Tuesday on Apple, Spotify, or any major streaming platform wherever you listen to your podcasts.
If you're fascinated by UFOs, aliens, ghosts, demons, cryptid creatures like Bigfoot, Chupacabra, and Mothman, then I have the show for you. The Paranormal 60 with Dave Schrader. Each week, we investigate different claims of the supernatural and try to shed light into the darkness, bringing you the top guests and experts from around the world. Enter the fray. Then join me, Dave Schrader, your host, as we investigate all aspects and claims of the supernatural and paranormal. Listen on all of your favorite podcast platforms, Good Pods, TuneIn, Pocket Casts, Deezer, Player FM, Amazon Music, Audible, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Google Podcasts, CastBox, Spotify, iHeartRadio, and Apple Podcasts. The answers to life's biggest questions and miracles and mysteries awaits you. So join me each week, two brand new episodes of the best in paranormal podcasting, The Paranormal 60 with Dave Schrader.
Scott, as I listen to you and I follow you and I started this with him, your most valuable tool and your most valuable asset that you use that is becoming in less and less resource is facts. You deal in facts. Your delivery is, and that sounds like, well, yeah, and, but it's such a rarity and you bring so much information to the table. I guess the reason I'm saying this, what's the machine? Where does this all come from? Because I sit here and I think I'm a pretty well-educated guy and pretty insightful, pretty analytic guy. And you blow me away with this shit. Where does this all come from?
Look, and this is my book, wealth and greatness are in the agency of others. People think it's me doodling and writing stuff and doing videos in my kitchen. I have 12 very talented people that work with me. I like to think my core competence is storytelling, but my superpower, Donnie, and I actually know this is true of you too, I think I have some talent at finding and retaining really talented people.
That's my thing. That was always my thing, man. I always find the people who are better than me, smarter than me. I mean, I have a certain thing maybe that they don't have, but, and I've had loyalty and passion from them because I care That's about right. their success as much as my own, and people will walk through fire at that point.
Sharing your own success.
Yeah.
Compensate them well, appreciate them, show some empathy, hold on to them. So if I come on a show like this and I know the topics, I start a Google Word document, my analysts, Mia, Ed, Jason, my editor-in-chief, start filling my head with things that make me sound a lot smarter than I am. Greatness is in the agency of others. If you ever really want to scale yourself, you have to find people who are super talented. And I was saying this about Morning Joe. I could just tell there was like several dozen really smart people teeing everything up.
Yeah.
So yeah, it's not like I'm a good front man, but be clear, you know, a lot of this is someone else's work.
Hey man, if you're a young person, you're listening out there, just surround yourself with great people. And you have to be secure enough to do that. You have to be secure enough to not only be around people that are teaching you, but at the same time, be secure enough and be human enough to say, I always say to people, just, you know, care about the other person's success and they'll know it. They'll understand that and they'll walk through fire and that's it. But I love hearing you say that. Something you got a lot of gunk for, but which I loved, when you came straight out and said, surround yourself with rich people. That's kind of a simple formula. It doesn't mean it's going to happen, but there's a lot of reasons to do it.
Yeah. And it sounds, I just hear it and I cringe. So I added surround yourself with wealthy and high character people. And I'm not right. suggesting you give up on friends if they don't, their W-2 doesn't progress. But you are the sum and then the average of the four or five people you hang out with most. So just try and find really high quality, successful people. Yeah, because, and also just going to work, people call me and say, should I take a job here or here? And I'm like, tell me about your boss. And I'm like, go to work for the richest boss. Because the bottom line is, if you go to work for someone really wealthy, it's really hard for them not to pay you well.
Yeah.
And they have more latitude. I just, and it sounds very crass, but you are going to end up the same body mass index, have the same politics, root for the same teams, live in the same neighborhood as the four or five people you surround yourself with. And you'll also end up about the same income level. The reason I went to college is that my two best friends in high school, one was a black kid who was going to school on a football scholarship. The other was a Mormon kid who didn't drink or smoke because he was going to go to Stanford. And I'm like, well, if Ronnie and Brett are going to college, so am I. And it wasn't a fait accompli for me. I was raised by a single mother who was a secretary. My father said, wanted me to get a job in shelving, making 18 bucks an hour, because that felt like a lot of money at the time. But because I was around two kids who was just, they were going to college, I went to college. It's also true of wealth. The unusual thing, though, and this is kind of the inspiration of the book, while you and your friends will end up in sort of the same income level, usually, one of you will end up poor and one of you will end up very wealthy despite having similar incomes. And that's the basis of the book. What are the strategies and behaviors for the guy or the girl, I say guy or gal, excuse me, who made the same amount of money as their peers, but by the time they're our age, they just had more money. They had more wealth. And there's a difference. We tend to focus on how much money we make as the key driver in wealth. A lot of it is the strategies and discipline and maturity around saving and deploying capital across a diverse set of low-cost funds early that compound, and you wake up. There's hundreds of thousands, probably millions of civic employees that never made more than $100,000 a year. But because they have great savings programs where it's pulled out of their check and it's matched by the government or their employee, they end up with $2 or $3 million by the time they're our age. So try and sell a best-selling book. Hope your company goes public. Hope you have a huge investment. But just in case, do what I didn't do. Put $200-$500 a month aside when you're in your 20s. Then try to get more than $1,000 a month when you're in your 30s and find a partner who's on board with that. And trust me, if it's low-cost index funds, no matter what happens when you're my age, you're going to be just fine. You're going to be just fine. This is your plan B. Everyone can do it.
You know what's so hard? And I love the advice. This fucking social media, because it goes in the opposite direction. Yeah. It just shows 100%. The interesting, fast, sexy buck. And that's the wind that you're pushing against with, because what you're saying is inarguable. And it's so smart. And it's something I would say to any young person. And I would give your book to any young person. The challenge is they're flying in the face of it with everything they're seeing 24/7 a day.
The most talented people working for the most well-resourced companies with godlike technology have one objective, and that is to psychologically and demographically and digitally test a million times a second how to turn you upside down and shake every goddamn penny from you. This morning, I order a tuna cotto and a protein shake from Joe and the Juice, and immediately pops up a thing. Hey, would you like to add flourless chocolate cake from Baltazar Boulangerie? And I'm like, I love cake. I mean, wait, just for $80 right now, in 3 minutes, you can upgrade to Economy Plus for $60. Wait, Girls Weekend? Make it special. Upgrade to a suite and go business class. It is near impossible not to spend all of your current income when you're a young person. I spent my first bonus from Morgan Stanley on a BMW, and I hung swim goggles off the rearview mirror despite the fact I didn't swim to try and impress strange women. I understand this. I get it. You're fighting instinct. You're fighting technology. But realize their job is to take every dollar you have and more. So try to get the Acorns app, round up your purchases. Find an investment vehicle at your company that, quite frankly, takes the money out of your paycheck so you never see it and never have that temptation, because 90% of people will spend everything they make in current income. And what you want is you want to build and deploy an army that every day gets bigger and goes out in your sleep and fights for you and your family and brings home the spoils. And you can do that. And when you're young, a little bit of money. I mean, Christ, Donnie, how fast has the last 40 years gone for us?
Fuck. Which basically, inside, I'll tell you how fast and how fast you feel it. I love the dedication in your book to your two sons to say, just make sure you take care of your old man. And that's, I don't know how the fuck we got here. I don't know how we got here.
And here's the thing. you have to, just as you have to fight the technology out there, you have to fight a human instinct or a human flaw. And that is, for 99% of our tenure on this planet, Homo sapiens, we haven't lived past 35. So we are literally incapable, when we're 25, of wrapping our head around the fact that you are going to be alive for another 80 years probably. And it's going to go really fast. Because most people think, oh, I'll figure it out. I'm a baller. I'm making a lot of money. I'm going to have something big happen. Well, just in case it doesn't, you realize if you just put $300 aside from the age of 22 to 30 and then $1,000 aside every month, not easy, but you can probably figure it out. This isn't a book for people who need to crowd up their credit cards and aren't making any money. This is a book for, I'm smart. I think I'm going to make decent money, but I want to make sure that I'm economically secure. Those little trade-offs and that consistency from a young age literally result in millions of dollars. You brought up the stat, 11% a year, S&P index funds, boring, just 11%. That means every 21 years, it's compounding at 8 times. So if I gave you a magic box and said, you can put $10,000 in this box, and in 40 years, which will fly by, it's going to be worth $400,000. How much would you put in that box? And ignore the 40 years, because trust me, my brothers and sisters, it's going to feel like an instant. So here's the box. It's called youth. Can you figure out a way to get $10,000 into that box and get $400,000 in what feels like an eye blink? How much money would you put in? Because anyone under the age, not only that, people think, oh, I'm 40, it's too late. That means you're going to live another 60 years. It's not too late. You have to get more aggressive. You have to put more into that box. But I think fight the flaw in the species. You're going to be around a lot longer than you think, and it's going to go a lot faster than you could ever imagine.
Amen. You know, there's a lot that you pick up rocks and you go, this is kind of scary. Give me some hope. Talk to me about some of the things that I should feel. I don't mean me, Donnie Deutsch, but a young person or anybody should say, okay, well, with all the fucking shit that's going on, with all the wars, with all these negative statistics, with all of the self-loathing of young people, with all of the transformation of wealth and going in the wrong direction, here's what you should feel good about.
I'm not good at this. I'm a glass half empty kind of guy.
Well, I'm going to make you fill up that glass.
Okay. Well, the good news is I hate my life less and less every day. Look, Saturday, right?
That's a great line.
Saturday. Saturday was the best episode of C-SPAN in several seasons. And that's how I can tell. There's several signs or tells you're getting older. The idea of a cruise doesn't horrify me any longer. And
it's so weird you said that. I saw something and I was like, yeah, that seems really comfortable and easy, and I don't have to worry about schlepping from one hotel to the next.
24-hour buffet. Yeah. Wake up in a different city. It doesn't sound like the seventh ring of hell anymore.
Right.
But, okay, Saturday C-SPAN. I watch C-SPAN now. This is what passed in one day. We're supporting we're pushing back on a murderous autocrat who decided to try and invade Europe. And we're sending a signal to the world that when the allies and democracies hold hands, get their shit together, that there really is no enemy we can't push back on. I think that's a wonderful thing. I think the invasion of Taiwan has been called off because of the allies' steadfast support and the bravery of the Ukrainian army. I think it sent a message to autocrats everywhere that the West can take out a third of your kinetic power, send to their unfortunate early death 100,000 of your countrymen, and push back on an army that was supposed to be in Kyiv within 48 hours when we get our shit together and bind together. And we finally got our shit together on Saturday, and we're sending aid to Ukraine. When a murderous religious cult goes into a sovereign nation and commits the worst atrocities since the Holocaust, We are steadfast. We immediately deploy aircraft carriers. This is a wonderful moment for the West, and we decided to send aid to Israel. And we are standing with a nation that believes in scientific research, jury trials, no fair and unusual, unfair and unusual punishment, bodily autonomy, a democracy. They are our ally. We are there for them. And then finally, I do think that the banning or the divestment of TikTok is smart from a defense standpoint. It strikes me supporting our allies, turning back murderous autocrats, and punching back or making sure our young people don't see that frame through the CCP. I really do think that, like Churchill said, America gets it right after exhausting every option, but we do get it right. And I feel much more optimistic about America in terms of us getting it right over the long term.
Well, final question before I let you go, and we're not going to talk politics, but along that lines, explain to me how so many smart people, I'm not talking about MAGA people, I'm talking, don't see, people I know, friends of mine, cannot see what would happen with the Trump presidency, and how, forget your politics, just to our fundamental, who we are, the way we operate, am I that smart that I see this in slow motion happening? What is the psychological resistance for 45% of this country, or not 45%, but a chunk of that, educated people, smart people, who cannot, will not let seep in what can really happen with a Trump presidency?
Well, so I live in London now, but I used to live in Delray Beach, and I'm kind of surrounded by Republicans and some Trumpers, and the majority of them are thoughtful, smart people. And I think I've gotten to know them a little bit better, or trying to understand them and empathize with them. Like, I'm part of the resistance. I'm involved in the Biden campaign. Mm-hmm. And if you're going to be part of the resistance, you have to go behind enemy lines. And as Robert McNamara said, empathize with your enemy. And I think this is their feeling. It's a lot of scaremongering that the world's going to go down the tubes with Trump. He's not as stupid as you think. The world didn't go to shit when he was in the office of the presidency. The president doesn't have as much impact as people think. Our institutions are strong. The majority of Americans are good people. I'm going to vote when I go into, I think a lot of people, distinct of what they say, only have one criteria when they go in behind a curtain, and that is who's going to put more money in my pocket.
Amen. Amen.
And I get it. I empathize with them. I love being the wealthy person that Republicans lower my taxes on every year. I like it. I can't help it. I've decided I care more about my kids. As someone who's become much more in touch with their Judaism as of October 7th, I like having an old hand on the wheel that is smart and has surrounds himself with smart people who respect him, as opposed to surrounding himself with, actually, there were some smart people in the Trump administration.
Oh, the first time around. That's the problem. The second time is going to be all sycophants. I mean, Gary Cohn, Dina Powell, McMaster, Mattis. I mean, there was, he actually, he's not going to do it this time. That's the difference.
And they all came to the same conclusion. This is a dangerous, stupid man.
Yeah.
And so I think they think, Scott, our institutions and our public are stronger than you think. Stop the scaremongering. The government is pretty ineffective. I just want the most money possible.
Yeah,
and I get it. And also, I think younger people are correctly and justifiably enraged at
they're
all
the
prosperity.
They're willing to blow it up.
They are not sharing it. So they're not voting for an individual. They're voting for chaos.
Yeah.
If you're not doing well, all you want is chaos and change.
Change. Let's do a do-over.
And okay, maybe I don't like him as a person, but he represents chaos and change.
Scott Galloway, I love that you said brothers from another mother. Of course, I just connect with just about everything you say. You're doing a lot of God's work. Keep doing it. The book, a must read, already Amazon number one, The Algebra of Wealth, a Simple Formula for Financial Security at any age, particularly if you're a young person, but at any age. Scott, keep up the good work, my friend.
Thanks, Don. And I meant this sincerely. I really appreciate your steadfast and early support of what's going on in the Middle East. It was harder for the earlier voices, and you were one of them.
Thank you. It means a lot to me. Stay well, my friend.